Time to take a look at climate and weather today with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, with me right now. John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, will be with us along about noon. He's finishing up teaching a class, and he will be along pretty shortly, as a matter of fact. So we'll look forward to that as well. You may have a weather question. You may have a climate question. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. I'd love to have a weather photo. We love those weather photos. You can post that up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. And do it soon so we can take a look at it. And Steve Ackerman, welcome.
Welcome, Larry. Thank you. I'm happy to be here during allergy time.
Steve is sounding a little bit like he's what is it? What are you allergic to?
You know, mostly it's when the trees come out. So it's really that early spring. That's when it tends to get.
Does it go away after a while?
It gets less. And I've kind of, as I was saying earlier, I just gotten back from New Zealand when it's fall down there, so it wasn't a problem. And all of a sudden I get here and it's like, oh, so I haven't been taking any drugs or anything, over-the-counter drugs to, you know, keep me normal. So I apologize for any sneezing that might happen.
Oh, well, that's all right. I tell you what, this is, we're in, by the way, what were you doing in New Zealand?
I had a conference down there. There's a group, the International Radiation Symposium, meets every 4 years, and this year was down there. IRS.
International Radiation. It sounds
right.
Kind of grim.
It's the good kind of radiation, so the kind we use on weather satellites to make observations and energetics for the atmosphere, solar radiation as well. So, yeah, not the Hulk kind of radiation, but Earth kind of radiation.
You're not glowing or anything.
I'm not glowing.
you look like you got through it okay. Oh, boy. So what do we consider severe weather, and why do we talk about it now?
Oh, we talk about it now because it's starting up pretty soon to the south of us. Severe weather in terms of thunderstorms, which is what we get in the summertime, you need warm, moist air near the ground.
Yeah.
And this time of year, we get it from the Gulf Stream, usually, flowing up from the south. And then you also need wind shear, both in speed and direction. And with thunderstorms this time of year, we get that with the jet stream. And coming out of winter, the jet stream's further south. So right now, it's severe weather storms, good chances for tornadoes climatologically in the southern U.S. And as we go through May and June, that moves northward
toward
to
us,
right, as the jet stream moves up.
Why is Oklahoma is an area? It seems like there's always many tornadoes.
It's Oklahoma gets the severe ones in particular, and that really has to do, believe it or not, with geography. So having the high plateaus to the west, just east of the Rockies, the foothills of the Rockies, sets up the right kind of airflow with the Gulf Stream. And the Mississippi Valley, with that moist air coming up from the south and the drier air coming from the west, sets up those rotations.
So they meet and they get some dandies.
Yeah. Now, Florida also gets a lot of tornadoes, but those are usually associated with hurricanes, and they're not the real strong ones, the F4s, F5s, EF4, EF5.
What's the worst tornado that ever hit anywhere that we know of? Is there an F8 or something?
No,
or?
The highest we go is to EF4, so that's the Enhanced Fujita Scale. We've kind of, the National Weather Service updated the Fujita scale that was developed in the 1980s, to measure the intensity of the hurricanes based on the damage that it's done. Of course, as time goes by, science engineering gets better, so our buildings were being built stronger, and so we had to modify that, and that's why we call it the Enhanced Fujita. But the highest this goes is EF5, and then it's pretty much everything is gone. So you can't get much higher than that.
Yeah, and so you've got, under those circumstances, for one of those, what are the wind speeds and so?
Oh, you know, off the top of my head, I don't know, probably like 300 miles per hour or so. Yeah, it's pretty strong.
Oh, and they can be huge.
They can be anywhere in size, and it's not so much the size of how big they are as it is the pressure drop in the rotation. But, we've seen them a mile wide, and so that's a pretty pretty long total destructive
path. That's
got to
be really something to look at coming at you.
Yeah, I saw a water spout, which is, you know, really, really weak in comparison to tornadoes, and that was scary. So I have absolutely no interest in seeing a tornado up close.
You want to be going the other direction.
I'll watch it on a video or something, but not the kind of thing I want to do.
And how fast does one move across the land? I mean,
they can move
300 miles an hour, but what about...
Yeah, they can move anywhere from, you know, a couple of miles per hour to 30, 40 miles per hour.
Okay.
So pretty radical. And you can't really predict a path. And this is why, you'll hear in terms of safety, don't try and outrun a tornado, you know, because it's kind of like you don't know the path that it's on, and it can catch up to you.
Yeah, Steve Ackerman, our guest today, talking about severe weather with him right now. You can join in with your own weather or climate question at 1-800-642-1234. Email us, too, at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'd love to hear from you. I got a note here. So you're speaking at Where's the Science, a conversation on the role of science in public policy on May 10th.
10th, yeah. I'm really looking forward to that event. It's hosted by the Wisconsin Academy of Letters, Science, and Arts. Sometimes I get those mixed up. It might be Arts, Letters, and Science.
I know the problem.
Right? But yeah, they're holding a great all-day symposium on May 10th looking at science and how it should and how it doesn't sometimes impact policy. So they got a great program set up. I kind of kick it off in the morning, and then at the end of the day, me and Steve Carpenter and Patty Lowe are on a panel to talk about it. But it's going to be they got a great program lined up.
Oh,
and not because I'm talking there, it's because of everybody else.
Well, so I better repeat this. So it's Tuesday, May 10th, from 7 to 8:30 in the evening. At the Marquee Theater at Union South.
Yeah, and that's
on campus,
open.
On the UW-Madison campus.
Yeah, and then they also have a symposium all day that you'd have to go on their website and register for.
But that's, which website?
The Wisconsin Academies.
Oh, the Wisconsin Academies,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
all
but
right.
The evening panel is open
to the public.
Anybody,
and it's free,
yeah.
I'm sure. No charge.
Right, yeah, no charge. Yeah, the
sure.
The symposium during the day does have a charge with it.
Well, we'll take some calls now. Again, you can join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Again, we'd love to hear from you. We've got Atlanta in Black River Falls next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I have a question about people with a phobia of storms.
Okay.
Namely me.
Okay.
I have very high anxiety around this time of year. When the sky gets dark, I kind of lose it a little bit. So I'm wondering, what can I tell myself? Like, when do I need to know, okay, now we go down to the basement and, you know, we stay safe down there?
Yeah. So I'll say,
how do I know it's bad?
Yeah. I think the good thing is that the forecasting is getting really good now on severe storms, knowing whether or not our tornadoes are inside or heavy hail is inside. So I think you can take comfort in that.
I think you can also, you know, the weather radios that are out there.
The weather radios, if you don't have one, I would go get one of those because they're usually good, too, at posting where those are.
And awesome.
Yeah, and then the other thing I would say is, you know, in terms of when to react, whenever you feel uncomfortable, that's the time to react.
Yeah.
So, I have a 6-year-old, and I got to say, I'm a little leery of giving him my phobia of storms.
Yeah.
I'm worried he's going to be anxious about them, too, so I'm trying to show him, you know, it's okay, but okay, now we need to go be safe. So we'll just depend on that accurate weather, and we'll get a weather radio.
And there should be when you have a youngster like that, have a little place downstairs where you're going to go. You might have a little setup down there so that when he comes down there, there's a book or there's some things that to do. So you're not just sitting in the corner of a kind of a. Well, if it'd be like at my place, like a dark, dreary basement.
Yeah. Yeah, something where he'll get worried, like, why are we just sitting here? Right? As opposed
not a
to.
A cool place to be sitting.
Right,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Andy in Sun Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
I have a backyard weather station and website, and I send my data to various places. One of them is Citizen Weather Observing and the NWS. And I guess my question is, what is the impact on forecasting through all these weather stations that the data is collected in the United States?
It's big. So the co-op observers, particularly if you're registered with them,
yes.
People will, you know, then they know that you have good quality data and you placed it in the right place. So some of that will get into numerical weather prediction models. And then also, I think when you have a small scale feature moving through, either from research or in real time forecasting, people will often go to those cooperative sites and look at what the data is doing. So, yeah, it's very important. I think.
And when you say a weather station, what's involved in a weather station?
Well, I have a Davis Vantage Pro 2 weather station backyard. It's a hobbyist weather station, and then I have a website also that, you know, it's my personal website, but that people, you know, you can, it's sunprairieweather.com, but it's you know, it's weather here, so I'm not getting my, you know, the temperature isn't from the Madison, it's
right,
from
yeah.
here in Sun Prairie.
Yeah, and so you're measuring, just to follow up on Larry's question, things like temperature, dew point, wind speed, wind direction. Probably
yes.
precipitation, maybe
correct.
Every hour or every 15 minutes. Wind gusts? Do you do wind gusts too?
Wind gusts, but my wind isn't as accurate as I'd like it to be because I'm in a somewhat sheltered residential area, so there's sort of a, you know,
right, yeah.
problem with that. But my data goes to my website like every 10 seconds, so it's updated
wow.
frequently.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
really fun to get, particularly like when a thunderstorm moves through. If you get on those web pages, and I think Weather Underground is another place where people will send their data, and then they'll put it out on their own web page, so you get everybody's there locally. And it's really
sure.
kind of cool to watch the variation of precipitation as it moves across the city.
Okay.
Oh, that's really cool.
Now, you can really see it's localized.
You must be a weather geek.
Yeah, I guess I am. You know, I kind of did it by accident, and... I bought the weather station because I had a real cheap one, and so I got a nice one. And then people started with these websites, personal websites, and I kind of joined in with them. And it's a kind of an online community of people who do this all across the country who have kind of more advanced websites. And everybody helps everybody. It's great.
Yeah, volunteer observations in weather throughout the history of meteorology has actually played a really important role. And it's a great way to get people involved and observing the atmosphere.
That's pretty cool. Thanks, yeah. Andy.
You bet. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Now, I should have asked him, what is one of those costs anyway?
Oh, boy, they can range in price from, you know, as he said, a cheap one. So, you know, it's probably $30 or something. Probably not too much.
Okay, that cheap.
To a couple of hundred. And I'm going to guess he's probably in that range.
or even higher.
Yeah, because if he's taking observations that quickly, that means he also has a Wi-Fi interface with his computer at home and stuff like that. So.
All right. We are talking with Steve Ackerman. John Martin will be joining us pretty quickly, too, to talk weather. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be right back. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along as we take a look at climate and weather with Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Science, as is John Martin, who is now joining us fresh from his class that he was teaching, and great to have him here as well. They come by once a month to talk with us. It's always pretty much all, no, it's always the last Monday of the month.
Yes, it's Labor Day. I mean, not Labor Day.
Unless
in May,
Day,
we come
yeah.
in on Tuesday, I think.
Yeah, right sometimes.
That's right, because of Memorial Day. So next month.
It'll be on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
It'll be the last Tuesday of the month. All right. We can deal with that for sure. We want to talk climate and weather with them. We talk a little bit about severe weather. It's that kind of time of the year when we're thinking about those kinds of occurrences. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments about climate or weather. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. We had there was a caller who called in who was kind of storm phobic. And Linda called to suggest that that particular person, there's a map of Wisconsin counties available so she can see where the storms are located. Linda had relatives who used the map, and it really kind of helped them.
So that's nice, in addition to,
I think, the weather radio. And you can adjust that. Can't you adjust the weather radio so that, like,
in terms of frequency of what it tells you?
Yeah.
I think you can. Maybe you can turn it so that it only alerts you if it's really dangerous and really local and so on. Yeah, I think you can do that.
Otherwise, somebody else was telling me, otherwise it goes off. If you just let it wide open, it'll be beeping all the time.
That's right.
Yeah, and if you had a weather radio in the past and you didn't like it because it beeped a lot, they've gotten a lot better at that, I should say. You know, the false alarm rate has been reduced.
Has gone down considerably. Okay. Well, we've got Steve in Ironwood, Michigan, with a question for you. Steve, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How you doing?
Great.
I have a two-part question. One is, what's the average distance a tornado travels in the ground? And part two is, what's the longest recorded distance one has traveled before it dissipates? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Good question. I think the average is about a mile or less than a mile.
I think it's a little less than a mile.
Yeah, less than a mile. And then... Yeah. I don't know if this is the longest one ever, but there was one on the ground during the famous April 3rd, 4th, 1974 outbreak over 13 different states. This one went through Xenia, Ohio, and some other towns. I think it was on the ground for 149 miles.
Oh.
But I actually have a suspicion that's not the longest lived tornado track. There may have been one from that outbreak just a few years ago.
2012, was that 2012, the big outbreak?
It was even longer. Yeah. So but that's astounding. It's way outside the norm.
Yeah. Right.
Why does it typically dissipate so quickly?
They're just so chaotic and short-lived storms by their nature. It's really hard to imagine keeping a... The thing is moving. The thunderstorm within which it's embedded is most likely not moving much faster than about 60 or 70 miles per hour forward speed. So to be on the ground for 150 miles, that's 2 hours long for a storm, which is just so unusual that it would stay coherent for that long and be able to remain funnel-like for 2 hours. I think that's it. Yeah.
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to be in front of one like that.
No. It's got those things got teeth. I mean, you don't want to be near them. You're absolutely right.
You've never seen one, have you?
No.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Ted in Toma, I have to tell you, I may have told this story about my dad, but I'll save that for a minute here. Ted in Toma has something for us. Hi, Ted.
Hey, how you doing today? This is kind of a weird time of year to talk about this, but I want to talk about wind chill. I was looking at a wind chill chart, I don't know, some time ago or whatever, and I was just curious to see how warm it gets outside or the wind or something before it has no effect on chilling. You know what I'm saying, kind of?
Oh, yeah. So, what's the threshold temperature where it doesn't make any difference?
Yeah, so I look way out there, and if you get out there, like, I don't know, I can't remember the numbers, but it was like, I don't know, let's just say it's 50 degrees and a 30-mile-an-hour wind or whatever, but the temperature went up a couple degrees. What's the deal with that?
I don't know.
We'll pull a chart up and look.
Well, you know what's funny? I can't talk about this as if I, you know, as an expert. I don't really know, but I think sometimes they make these charts and they know what the sensitive spot is. They really want to know what's happening with cold temperatures and high winds. And then they come up with an empirical relationship that has a mathematical formula underneath it that starts to play games on the extreme ends on the other place where you don't care about it. That's possible. That's what's happening. Because I think it's unphysical to suggest that if you're outside on a 60-degree day and the wind's blowing at 30 miles per hour, that you actually feel warmer in the wind. That doesn't make any sense, does it?
Right.
Yeah.
But it was only like a degree or two. So
yeah.
I thought it must be... It just seemed kind of weird.
It does to me, too.
So I agree, and so I'm going to give you a situation which I've wondered about in the past, but it wouldn't be in the wind chill charts.
Yeah.
And that's the situation where I remember in Saudi Arabia looking at the temperatures, and the temperatures were like 110, right? And the wind was 30 miles per hour. So in that situation, again, the wind chill is really a measure of how fast you cool down.
Yeah.
So in those situations where the temperature is much above the body temperature, it would be how fast you heat up.
Oh, I guess so, yeah.
And so the wind chill could be a positive number in that extreme case.
But you'd think it'd have to get up into the mid-90s.
You'd have to get above 98.7 degrees before.
Wow, that's weird.
Before that could happen. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Very interesting.
So, yeah, we'll have to look at the charts.
That's a really good mystery. That could be one or both of those things, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Ted.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Don in Spooner has something for us. Hi, Don.
Hey. I wanted to suggest to the young woman who's afraid of storms that she take a weather spotter class. They're offered all over the state. My husband takes it every year, and I work evenings, so I can't. But I've learned so much just from what he comes home and tells me, and it's helped to ease my mind about storms. He can say, oh, no, those are those kind of clouds, and that means it's just a garden variety.
That's a great suggestion.
I agree with that.
And they're actually running those courses now as well, because we just came out of severe weather warning week. Awareness week.
That is a really good
idea.
That's
a great idea. Yep.
Thanks, Don.
If you're afraid of it, check it out.
Yeah, that's the way to look. Thanks, Don. Yeah, appreciate it. Really good idea. Todd in Madison, up to you now. Hi, Todd.
Hi. I was told that the UW is involved in a research project measuring the polar ice cap shrinkage and such. And it was explained to me how that affects the local weather, but I'm not sure if the person really directly affects the weather, if they were a scientist or not. Could you explain that, and is it true the UW is involved in that research?
I'll talk about the research and let John explain it.
Yeah, okay.
So there are a couple of programs that I know of that people are dealing with. One is routine observations of the Arctic sea ice sheet and how that's changing with time. I know I have a grant with a couple of other folks in our department that deals with ice leads and the cracking of ice. And the hypothesis there is that if it's shrinking and thinning, then it should be cracking more. And that emits a lot of moisture flux into the atmosphere, which could change the weather. And then I know we have another group that's looking specifically at the Greenland ice sheet and what causes that to melt, and particularly undergo rapid melting situations.
Yeah, and then the effect of warming the planet to an unusual degree at high latitudes in the northern hemisphere, where the hemisphere is covered with ice at the highest latitudes. If some of that sea surface gets ice-free, then that tends to make the subsequent fall and early part of the winter a little bit warmer than it should be at high latitudes, which has ramifications for the whole circulation of the northern hemisphere. Exactly what those ramifications are is now a very hot topic in research. Lots of people are kind of looking at that from a variety of different perspectives that all those individuals have acquired over their professional careers. So I'm working right now with some people who have very much a climate perspective on this problem. I have a weather systems perspective on it, and they're very different perspectives, as it turns out. But that hybridization of the way we're looking at this might be a really powerful ally in our trying to understand it better.
Interesting. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Tracy in Wausau up next. Hi, Tracy.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yes, I just wanted to comment. I recently moved here from Kansas, and one of the more interesting jobs, part-time jobs I had while I was down there was launching weather balloons with some meteorologists out of the University of Colorado during tornado season.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a very unique experience to see how all that data was gathered by sending up the radio sonds and what actually happens to those sons once the balloon pops and it comes back down to earth. I actually ran into a few ranchers down there that said they would find them out there on their property, but it was a unique experience just seeing how that data was collected. And I worked with some storm chasers that would go out and follow these tornadoes during the tornado season.
Cool.
But it was just a great experience to see how that data was collected by these giant weather balloons that you launched.
I think that is pretty cool. I've only launched one a couple of times for demonstration purposes in a class, so I've never been operational like you did. But that's done.
Sure, we launched them out of an airport, and we, you know, depending on how much data they wanted from the different locations, sometimes it was hourly, sometimes it was every few hours. And so it was very interesting. And then
it would
go down to, I think the headquarters was in Norman, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And
did that field experiment have a name?
I don't remember what it was. It was about 5 years ago.
It's probably Vortex.
It had something to do with NASA also.
Mm. Yeah.
Vortex?
It's probably called Vortex, if it was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It was probably called Vortex. There was a big experiment about 5 years ago that involved NASA, NSF, NOAA, and a lot of universities studying the initiation of vortexes.
Yeah. Right. Oh. In fact, one of those summers, they didn't have that many.
That's right.
Which almost always happens. And then the data ends up being interesting for other reasons. So it's always good
there's
to
always
get
weather.
It. Yeah, there's always something to talk about.
How big are these balloons anyway? Are they huge? Or
by the time they break, they're about the size of a house.
Yeah, they're
gigantic.
Oh,
my goodness.
Yeah.
They get that big?
They get that. I mean, they're getting up, you know, what, 20 kilometers?
Yeah, or higher sometimes. Yeah. And then the instrument package has postage already paid on it, doesn't it? If
right,
you find
yeah.
it, you can just put it in a mailbox. It gets measured, sent back to the weather service.
Yeah, but I don't think they get very many back. I think
they
people
must
just
not.
Tend to keep
yeah.
it. Yeah.
I would. I have to tell you, if I got one, I'd keep it.
Keep it right, yeah.
It'd be kind of interesting to have on the shelf.
Yeah.
Why not?
Right. You know? Actually, somebody was telling me, and again, this is associated with an ex-field program in Kansas, and this was in the 90s, you know, where they went into a farmer's barn because they'd heard he had found one of these radios on. And his barn had like a dozen of them just sitting on shelves,
wow.
right? You know, and he was collecting them. He's like, I'm not mailing this. I'm going to collect this.
Wow. Well, he's probably in just the right spot. You
right
know,
in the right,
winds
right.
and all that.
Yep.
Downwind to Topeka or someplace
right.
like that. Dodge City.
Oh, there you go, Tracy. Thanks a lot for calling. Allie and Jefferson, your turn. Hi.
Hi, I'd like to know, what is the difference between partly cloudy skies and partly sunny skies?
I think it's your perspective.
Yeah.
I'm honestly the case. I don't know the answer either. I think I don't know if there's a numerical distinction between the two. I think it might just be the way you choose to broadcast it. I hope I'm not. I hope I'm wrong about that, but I honestly don't know.
So I would say partly cloudy means you are just have a few scattered clouds.
Mm.
So it's sort of like mostly sunny.
Yeah.
And partly sunny is like mostly cloudy.
Oh, okay.
right?
So that makes sense.
Oh.
Yeah.
But what's the difference between partly cloudy and mostly sunny?
Yeah, maybe there isn't.
I think that's more of a perspective, right?
Yeah.
You want it to be mostly sunny.
Right.
there we go, Allie. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Mark in Richland Center up next. Hi, Mark.
You guys mentioned the weather spotter stuff, or maybe the other caller did. And what do you look for in terms of different kinds of clouds? So what do you call these different kind of clouds? Like today we got big poofy ones, and on some days we got big poofy clouds, and then we got straight line clouds that cover from horizon to horizon, and then they spread out. So what do you call those clouds that start out as straight lines, and then they spread out, and they go across the from horizon to horizon? But they don't stay at a certain width, if you like. They get wider and spread out. What do you call those clouds?
Those are usually some form of cirrus clouds that have that characteristic. Maybe cirrus sissipatus, which is the kind that tends to spread out, is the one that does that. Not very often are they connected directly with either severe weather that's in the next 6 hours or severe weather that just passed. It's rare that that's the case. That's often a fair weather kind of cloud.
And how high are they?
They're probably between 5 and 8 miles high, depending on where you are in the world. They're pretty high up there.
So if you see ones that are lower than that and they're spreading out, starting out almost pencil thin,
mm-hmm.
and then get spread out to a much wider width in a short amount of time, what causes that?
That might be a stratocumulus cloud in that case, because stratus are the lower layer clouds, and if they have an ability to grow in their aerial extent, and also you might not see it, their vertical extent, then they have a cumuliform aspect to them, too. And so that might be a stratocumulus deck that's starting to fill in as a approaching warm front or some other kind of weather system comes your way.
And then what happens if those clouds actually look like they've been originating out of the rear end of an airplane as it's traveling across the sky?
That's just a condensation trail from the propellants that come out of the airplane then in that case. And they can also, once they start to form, there's water vapor in that atmosphere and also in the propellants, and they can be subject to the same kinds of growth mechanisms that a naturally occurring cloud would be. If it's convective in that environment, they'll grow into cumuliform looks to them, or sometimes they'll just be pencil thin and stay that way for a long time.
And they've got to have certain conditions for that to happen?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So one of those conditions would be the amount of condensation that's in the air altogether, that the total moisture content of the air has to be at a very high level of density of moisture concentration in the air in order for that.
Yeah, in combination with the other chemicals that come out of the engine. That's correct. Some of those chemicals are water vapor out of an engine too.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Mark. And Dan in Stevens Point up next. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. Thank you for putting me on the call here. I wanted to ask your guests about the impact of climate change on Wisconsin weather. You're dealing with severe weather right now, and I know that the weather that results from climate change is going to be more severe, heavier storms, longer storms, and I'm sure you're going to be dealing with this at the May 10th presentation at the Wisconsin Academy, but can you talk a little bit about how climate change will impact Wisconsin in the years ahead?
Yes, yeah, so I would say two things that immediately come to my mind. One is the wintertime. So as we look down the road, while it's already happening, the winter gets shorter in general. We're still going to have winter storms, but that winter time, in terms of we'll have snow on the ground or ice on the lakes, gets smaller. And then, as you were saying, the intensity of the precipitation has been going up in the Great Lakes regions in general. In the sense that even though we may get the same amount of rainfall, it seems to come in shorter, heavier doses with more time when we don't have precipitation. So those are the two things that come to my mind immediately.
Yeah, I think that's probably the couple that would get in my consciousness too. I think we've made, our community's made too much of a big deal about individual weather systems being more extreme, and we should be expecting more extreme and a higher frequency of extreme storms in an altered climate. I frankly do not believe the evidence is in yet to really make that statement categorically, and it's now gotten into people's bloodstream in a way that, as I think, probably obscuring what needs to be some additional research on that problem. So I think what Steve says is exactly right. It's undeniable the winter is getting shorter. Ice coverage on the lakes is shorter than it used to be. It's undeniable also that we do get a higher frequency of intense rainfalls in the summertime, but I'm not sure what that's going to mean for the long term.
And I think, yeah, just follow what John's saying there. I mean, the thing about extreme events is that they're extreme, and so the statistics,
right.
You need a long time period
Very
to get the statistics
time.
To understand mm-hmm.
exactly.
anything that changes there.
But if you have less ice on the lakes, or though it's on for less often, then you're going to have more water loss, I would think, too, from your...
I think that's correct, yeah. I think it's going to be tougher to keep water in the smaller lakes around here over the course of the winter,
yeah.
because
yeah,
the ice goes on later and comes off earlier. Yep.
Yeah.
I assume it's also going to affect fishing in Wisconsin, too.
Already has, yeah.
Yeah, the lake temperatures are going up, stream temperatures are going up, and fish like particular...
It's going to have
regimes.
A big impact on trout.
Yeah, and they're extremely
sensitive.
Within
really
a degree Fahrenheit or something of the water temperature, it makes a difference for them. Yeah. So there's not much wiggle room there.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And Lee in Green Bay, hello, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I just want a quick question. Controlling the weather, I know this has been talked about. In fact, a previous caller kind of brought this up. The... exhaust from the so-called exhaust from the jets on nice clear days. This, as far as I'm concerned, is what they call geoengineering. They're spraying chemicals up there.
What's the evidence for that?
Is there evidence for that?
What is it? Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of talk now, and I know the National Academies just came out with a document, although I have not read it, on geoengineering as they look to the future with climate change. And actually, the number of people on that panel were actually pretty impressive. I don't know what they concluded. I got to go read it. But the thing that, I mean, my thing has always been, in terms of weather modification, we tried this in the 50s and the 60s with trying to reduce hail size or increase precipitation in the mountains in order to have more snowfall. And we have no idea if it happens.
Right.
We have no idea.
The whole idea of geoengineering, maybe I'll get in trouble for saying this, but it strikes me as the height of arrogance that we could actually make a small modification with no unintended consequences that would be negative and ameliorate a problem that we have other means to maybe ameliorate over a longer period of time.
Yeah.
I don't understand the motivation for it. And certainly there's nothing to this notion that there are vast fleets of aircraft flying around the world spraying chemicals to try and do any of this, because this is just forgetting that the atmosphere is 6 million billion tons.
Yeah. So there we go, Lee. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. A chapter a day coming up in just a minute, and I did want to mention that Carl Schmidt passed away this past week, and I wanted to comment on that. You know him for the wonderful job he's done for like 60 years, reading Chapter a Day, For me, he was a whole lot more. When I started on public radio, I was 20 years old. I wasn't any good at all, to be perfectly honest, on the air. And I went to Carl, and he, along with Ken Oss, pretty much saved my career in broadcasting. to not put too fine a point on it. And I learned an awful lot from him. And a lot about interviewing, listening to him on Saturday mornings. He used to do a show with Dr. H. Kent Tenney. And it was just a wonderful show to listen to him, that sort of laid-back, friendly interview style that I tried to emulate a little bit. And so thank you, Carl, and I hope you rest in peace. And thank you all for listening today. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, they'll be back with us next month for another look at climate and weather. Tomorrow we'll be talking with a dermatologist about our skin. Thanks for listening on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.